Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to episode 219 with actor Terrence McSweeney. But first, a bit about our sponsor. This episode of Yes But Why podcast is sponsored by Audible. You can get your free audiobook download and your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. My guest this week, Terrence McSweeney, absolutely loves Shakespeare. He can literally turn any subject into a discussion on the Bard. Let's see what Audible has to say about Shakespeare. There's plays you can listen to. There are entire courses to teach you how to understand Shakespeare like Terrence does. Oh, and there's this bit of historical fiction here. William Shakespeare's Star Wars. The George Lucas story we know in iambic pentameter. Nice. Audible is available for your iPhone, Android, or Kindle. Download your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. This week on Yes But Why, I talked to fellow University of Dallas drama alum, Terrence McSweeney. Terrence is an actor and a stay-at-home dad in New Jersey. In our conversation, Terrence prophesies the reformation of theater after COVID, and I like his ideas. I now present to you Yes But Why, episode 219. Terrence McSweeney is an artist to the core, and his creativity will weather the storm. Enjoy. I'm Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah.
I mean, when I was young, like I said, I used to consume Inside the Actor's Studio mad. But again, it wasn't even on YouTube. I mean, there was no YouTube.
No.
So it was only when I went to my grandmother's house when she had cable, that I could watch it.
Yeah,
so,
right? It was on Bravo or A&E or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I would have killed for a podcasting world where I could learn everything about, or hear everything about, what it's like to be an actor or what it's like to be a performer or a creative or whatever,
Yeah.
So I think it's,
You know what though? I'm not trying to get people to give out their secrets. So don't worry. You don't have to reveal any of your acting secrets. If you're like, I've figured out that if you
I'm giving them to everybody.
No, you don't have to. I'm just saying if you want to keep that part, if you want to, I respect Uta Hagen and keep that. For me, it's more about how it makes you feel and why that keeps your interest. I actually really believe that we could all do anything. You're meant to do this. No, this is what I'm doing because there was a person in my life who showed me that this was an option and it went well for them, so I went for it. Right? It didn't it's not like if everybody in my family was a trash collector, maybe that's what I'd do because I'd be like, hey man, good job, solid benefits. I get weekends off. I'm in. Right? Who knows? Who knows what kind of lifestyle? But I could probably do whatever because to a certain extent, creativity is found everywhere. Right? So if I'm dying to be creative, I could do any number of things. Right? I can still be doing karaoke on the weekends with my friends or hosting the bowling night. Hey, everybody who's excited to bowl, those people, every single person who is in a presentational mode, the people who do the announcements at high school football games, they're all doing a show. They're all using the same talent that we have to put this out, to present stuff, to make everybody else's life a little bit more fun for this moment, right? So I don't know. Yeah. That's why I say this is hard. There's a lot of things telling you to say no. Why do you keep doing it, right? But let's do this. Let's start with we tiny Terrence, okay? We're a tiny child, because I'm going to assume, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm going to assume that you were like a born actor, that you were like a tiny little child holding a skull doing monologues, right? That's what I imagine for you.
Unfortunately, yes. Yes, that is actually true. So, yeah, go ahead.
Yes. So my first question is, what was the performance or, you know, play or event that you did where you performed that was the one that you knew, yeah, this is my thing. I'm going to do this.
Well, so I think it was, well, I guess I would say there was two thresholds. And they were both, they were both pretty early. Well, one was high school, so I'll get to that in a second. But the first one was in fourth grade. There was they were doing a school play. It was being done through our music class, and it was The Revolt of the Foolish Molar. And it was all about the importance of brushing your teeth and not eating sweets. And the foolish molar, of course, was the sweet tooth, and he wanted to eat a lot of sweets, and then he ended up developing a cavity. And, you know, and these are all the teeth. You know, the play was all the teeth in Johnny's head. So Johnny was the boy, and, you know, brushing, you know, yeah, he has to learn how to brush his teeth. And I remember specifically, I kind of come from a family of actors. I mean, my dad was an actor, my mom was an actor. They both met at an audition in their undergrad, you know, program. And my dad, you know, ended up getting tired of acting, and so he sort of gave it up. And then he, you know, went and taught Latin for a while, and then he became a lawyer for the city where I grew up, Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is blowing up in the last few years. And he continued to teach as a humanities teacher until just recently. He just recently retired, and my mother also became a professor. And I always, you know, theorized that was maybe how they got their acting bug out. But everyone in my family, I think this is safe to say, I think this is true, yeah, everyone in my family has acted at some point or another. You know, school plays, debate tournaments, forensics, all that kind of stuff. And now, I think all of my siblings, they all either write or speak for a living. You know, they're lawyers or they're teachers or they... You know, my brother is an event organizer. You know, he sort of fell into that. He was a writer for a while. He also was an actor. I mean, they all kind of do that. But anyway, so that was kind of the background I came from. But I remember when I was at the audition for that fourth grade play, The Revolt of the Foolish Molar. And I remember I know, right? I know. That was how it worked. We were all like in fourth grade, and we were all just sitting there in class. It was like when we were at UD, you know, everyone auditions in front of each other, you know, and the teacher, the music teacher, was giving out sides. You know, we literally had, you know, little sides there. And I remember that the Foolish Molar's little speech was, it was after the Foolish Molar, you know, realizes the error of his ways. So he's having like a bellyache. I mean, he's a tooth, but he's having a bellyache. Uh-huh. And it was like the lines were something like, you know, oh, I'm so sick. You know, I shouldn't have eaten all that candy. Oh, I wish I hadn't made that bad decision, you know, something like that. And all these kids get up there and they audition for it. And they're all going, oh, I feel so sick. I should never have eaten all that candy. Oh, I never should have made that decision. And I was just like, what is going on, you guys? Like, you know how it's supposed to go. So then when I got up there to audition, I go, oh, I'm so sick. And I'm like doing all this kind of stuff, you know. And I just thought that was just kind of the way it's supposed to go. I didn't really think I was going to get the part or anything. I was just sort of kind of showing everybody, like, guys, you know, cut loose. Go for it. You know, don't hold
it
back.
Up, man. We're in fourth grade. It gets downhill from here.
Exactly. And I remember, like, you know, our music teacher was really sweet. She used to let us bring in contemporary music and dance. The way, you know, the way the modern kids dance, you know, that kind of stuff. And so I would get up there and I'd imitate MC Hammer and stuff like that, making a complete fool of myself. And I mean, I got some serious laughs, Amy. Like, it was nuts. But I there's something about that has stuck with me that yeah, you can sort of, you can show up your competition by just, you know, going one step farther than them. You know, and there was even an audition that I had just a few years ago. It was like probably the biggest contract I've had at like a regional theater. It was for Macduff in Macbeth. And I'd already played Macduff at the time, and I knew what the traps were with Macduff. And one of the traps is, you know, in the play Macbeth, Macduff is the one who discovers Duncan's dead body, the king's dead body, after, you know, Macbeth has killed him. And he comes out, you know, after seeing the body, and he's got this speech, like, where he's freaking out, saying, the king is dead, you know, and I saw this blood, and it's crazy, and all this kind of stuff. And I remember sitting outside the audition, and in the room, I heard every actor before me go in there and make the same mistakes that I had made when I had previously played Macduff, which was, you know, just going crazy and like screaming and this blood and everything. And it's never very believable. And you're going against the text. The text isn't really like that. And so I remember thinking like, well, you know what? I've already played this role. I want to contrast myself with every other actor. So I instead did it just a completely different way. You know, I knew that I at least did it differently than the previous three or four actors that went ahead of me while I was sitting out there. And I just did it, you know, much more quietly and sort of, you know, like he was shell-shocked, like he, you know, mumbling, like he didn't really know what to say. And, you know, he had blood on his hands and things like that. And I ended up getting the part. You know, I think somebody else was cast ahead of me, and then that actor dropped out. And, you know, then they called me and offered the part. So it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like a sweep. It wasn't like a major coup where I got the part. But either way, it worked. You know, I got through to the director, and he saw what I was capable of. And something about that first fourth grade audition and then that Macduff audition that I was telling you about, it all has to do with there's something about competition which works really well with me. Like if I feel, I mean, I feel like I know pretty well, like, okay, this actor's acting in this style in this play that I'm in, and they're acting opposite me on stage. If I want to distinguish myself, there are choices I can make that will stand out, you know. If one person's doing all the hammy stuff or they're really going for the emotion or something, maybe you should hold back. Maybe you should be a little bit more, you know, articulate and clear and cerebral or something. And then on, you know, conversely, if somebody's being really cerebral, maybe you should go for it a little bit, you know, kind of like those fourth grade, you know, students, you know, my fellow students who were kind of playing it a little safe when they were reading, you know, As the Tooth. So in a weird way, yeah, it's like,
do you do that in, yeah, like, all your auditions? Do you, like, set your audition time, like, later in the day and then just go and sit and listen to how everybody else does it and then go in and do something, like, different just to, like, you know, they're, like, six cup of coffees in and they're, like, oh, God. And then you do something different and they're, like, this guy, now this guy's got something. Is that your key? In the hole?
I mean, not strategically, but... But I did it that one time with the Macbeth one, or the you know, and honestly, like, no, you can't try usually, you know, like, choose. Sorry, what now?
I said, hey, try it again.
I was just gonna say, like, you can't usually choose, like, when exactly in the day you'll go. But I know what you're talking about, because did you do forensics in high school?
No, we didn't have those things in Boston.
Oh, gotcha. Well, I did, you know, the speech and debate competitions. And they're an incredible, incredible training ground for actors. And that was my technique when I would do, you know, the competitive acting in forensics competitions. I always wanted to, I would sometimes pretend that I had a conflict with another round, maybe another event, so that they would put me last. You know, I would go and do that event and then come back for the event, you know, the performance that I really cared about, because I wanted to go last. Because if you, you know, if you watch a bunch of, you know, you watch 10 actors in a row, the last one, you know, just by, you know, if you're good, you're good. But if you're the last one, you're also, if the first one is really, really good, but, you know, they saw that an hour ago and then mm-hmm. there's, you know, so that was a conscious strategy that I made in high school when I was doing competitive acting. But I wouldn't necessarily employ that when I was auditioning. But I do think that, I don't know, there's something about, learning from your fellow actors, but also giving and taking with them. You know, it's important for you to know, like, okay, that guy's the lead. that guy's got all the important lines, you know, don't upstage them, but also, you know, you can be distinctive if you underplay it, or you can be distinctive if you overplay it, or you can be distinctive, you know, just things like that. I don't know. Something about that kind of, competition. I mean, I guess I always felt like it was a competition for, you know, we've all got a really serious job to do, and that's keeping the audience's attention. So, you know, being hyper-focused on that, I don't know whether it served me well or not, but that's just what I care about. I care about making sure I'm getting through to the audience.
Is that the thing that drives you through the whole thing? Is it the competitiveness? I mean, because it is a very competitive profession, you know, for you to get roles at all is, you have to be pretty impressive, right? So is that the thing sort of buoys your creativity?
Well, yes, but only in the creative sense. It has nothing to do with the profession. Like, I'm not good at playing the game professionally at all. The way I sort of employ it is you know, sort of like you said. I mean, as far as what keeps me competitive, what keeps me creative, is you know, making sure I'm getting through with the audience. That's really all I care about. I mean, I would do this for free if there was some other way I could support. You know, I could have money coming in and I could just do this for free. I would just do it for free. I just care about, you know, how can I be a better actor? That's all I care about. And, you know, so much theater, unfortunately, is boring. It's just boring. I mean, I hate to say it because I love theater and I love actors, but I feel like if we don't admit that to ourselves, we're never going to improve it. And so that was always, that's more of my drive, I would say. I mean, the competitive thing is real, but it's too much of a C. There's no way you're going to be able to be, you know, to let your competitiveness help you dominate or something in this profession, because there's just too much other talent and it's all good. That's the thing. People are really, really good. American actors are really, really good. It's astonishing. And so when plays aren't that good, because again, that's sort of my focus. I mean, I'm just not interested in movies and television. I've auditioned for them. I've done them and I just don't care. If the audience isn't there, or we're not getting ready for when the audience is there, it's very hard for me to stay focused. And that's a weakness. I don't consider that a strength, but it's just who I am. You know, I care about live acting.
More into the experience in the room with the people, you know what I mean?
Right.
Than they are about there being some sort of finished product that other people could see later. And I appreciate that. My experience in improv is always such that it's like one of those things where, you know, like after an improv show, if somebody's like, oh, did somebody tape it? It's like, no, it's not, you know, you're not watching it later. Like, you were in the room or you weren't, you know, you were at the party or you weren't. And that's what, that's what theater is like. It's like you got FOMO, we'll get in there. Like, you're wondering what's happening, go see it. You know, and well, I mean, as far as things being boring, I think a long time ago, somebody decided that like anything made after like 1900 was the worst thing that ever happened. And then like they were just going to be like, let's just go for everything old. And the problem is that like a lot of the references are too old for people to get, or the idea of it.
Yeah.
Not everything flies as well as Shakespeare that was made that is its contemporary and whatnot, you know? And plus there's a ton of stuff that literally was, plays are often written not to make you have a great time, but also to make you think or make you mad or elicit any number of reactions from you. I've worked on a lot of plays where I'm like, wow, this is just everyone sad all the time. And it's like, yeah, it's about that.
Right.
And you're like, oh, all right.
Right, okay, right. And then, cool. And those are the masterpieces. Yeah,
sure, exactly. Sure. People love them sad, well, right?
And I have a hunch. I have a little, you know, I mean, I consider myself, you know, tongue in cheek, but I do consider myself the Shakespeare evangelist, you know, as I've, you know, talked to you about before. And I do, and I really mean this, I do, and I have had visions of a theatrical apocalypse. And then the freaking coronavirus came along and I was like, God damn it, I was right. And now I have a hunch. I have a real hunch here. This is a prediction. When theater comes back, there are going to be, I think naturally there are going to be some reformations that are going to be made. And I think that classical literature is going to make a little bit of a resurgence, because I mean, I just know for myself, once the coronavirus hit and I'm stuck at home, And I've got all the time in the world now to watch all the Netflix shows that I wanted to see and everything. It's weird how instantly out of date everything seems because of the coronavirus.
Yeah.
And what doesn't seem out of date is, you know, the great stories of the past, you know, and great classical theater. I mean, I really think, you know, I have a friend, a good friend who's a director that I've worked with. He's cast me many times. He's a great director, but he hasn't done any Shakespeare. You know, that was never part of his wheelhouse. It was never part of his training. And he was telling me that, you know, now he doesn't really want to do anything other than the Greeks, you know, and Shakespeare and things like that, because just something feels weird and sort of hollow and not relevant about a lot of contemporary theater. You know, and I wonder, I think those great stories are going to come back.
I think we're also going back to like original stories. We're like going back to the stories that are the tropes to figure out why they're the tropes all of a sudden. Cause I noticed a lot of that, like a lot of people are, you know, getting into old school, like, oh, let me read these kinds of fairy tales, or like, let me, you know, get into Greek mythology or these gods or whatnot, this mythology situation. Like, what were we watching? We were watching some Greek mythology show. You know, I'm a UD grad like you are. That's what we do sometimes. Yeah. There was a thing, it was just a Greek myth, and we watched it, and it was this beautiful, like, 1970s film of it, and it was really nice, and it was, like, themes that made sense and like that had universality, and I was like, this is just like what we're doing right now. Or, you know, like, because a lot of the Greek stories are born out of war, and so when we are in our roughest spots, that's when they seem like they make the most sense. Like, you know, I agree. What I mean?
Totally and they're connected. I mean, it's remarkable, right? You know, Jungian, you know, archetypes, you know, tap into this a lot. But, you know, whether it's, you know, Indian mythology, or whether it's Greek mythology, or whether it's, you know, some of the ancient Chinese folk tales. I mean, they're all so similar. It's amazing. We can feel, I think, that that's what connects us. That's what connects all of us. And that's what, you know, I think so. They're great stories for a reason.
I would put money on the fact that movies of the future, like in the next year or two, that a lot of movies are going to have like old stories redone.
I completely agree. I think it's coming. And I think a lot of the things in those old stories, which seem very shocking and very un-PC, this is something which just clicked with me just recently. It's usually because you're not viewing them symbolically. Once you view them symbolically, then you understand, like, oh, this isn't about misogyny, or this isn't about, you know, some sort of, you know, outdated mode of parenting or something like that. This is about, you know, this character is a symbol for something. They represent something which we still see in our society nowadays. I mean, the basic sort of, I think the basic psychological types, you know, the basic personalities haven't changed really. You know, I mean, the period that I study a lot because I'm obsessed with Shakespeare is, of course, Shakespeare's era, the sort of the 100-year period in England, which Shakespeare was right in the middle of. And those, the Puritans, you know, and the Puritans were the ones who ended up taking over England and, you know, just completely wiping English culture clean and sort of starting over. And it didn't last very long. And then there was the restoration of the monarchy, and England tried to sort of figure out who they were after that and everything. But those Puritans, they still exist. You know, and there's nothing wrong with that. But we need all types of psychological types in society to have dialogue with each other. People who want to defend tradition and the people who say that we need change and they want to criticize, you know, our culture or our society. We need all of it. We need all of it. And so when I look back,
diversity is. Like when people are trying to get diversity is a bunch of different people with different point of views that came from different backgrounds and lived different kinds of lives and have different kind of education, so that their experience from their life can be beneficial together with everybody else's, right? It's like, what do you guys think about this? Well, I think this, I think that, I think this. This is my experience. This is my experience. That's what diversity is good for. Actually finding out what a real solution or what a real story is, or what, like, how people really think about stuff in a larger setting, like in the most communicative setting, right? Yeah.
Totally. And you find them, the more you study, you know, history and any other societies, you still find those people. They're always, there's a great book actually that was sort of the basis of a lot of my thinking about Shakespeare. It's by Ted Hughes, the poet, and it's called Shakespeare and the Goddess of Complete Being. And that's sort of one of the points that he brings up is, you know, that there's these sort of images and notions that have been passed down through mythology that found themselves in English culture, they're still around, and that's what, yeah, exactly. We need that dialogue between all the different points of view. That's what logos is really in the West. You know, from the Greek, it means word or idea or something. But I think what it means to me is when you have dialogue with other people. And you say, like, I see reality this way. And they say, well, I see reality this way. You in dialogue, you find a compromise between them. And you build reality between the two of you, or the four of you, or the thousand of you, or the 330 million of you. I mean, whatever it is. But only through dialogue. You have to keep those channels open. And that's why I think theater can save us. It really can. I mean, except for in the time of coronavirus, this incredibly bizarre, you know, disease, which nobody saw coming, which was, you know, I mean, I always said to myself, you know, certain traditions of theater might die out, but theater itself can never die out.
No,
because
no.
Theater is just, it's exactly. But at the same time, it's fascinating living through a time like this where it's like you can't get together with other people. You are not allowed. It's dangerous.
Plus, the other thing about, like, a lot of people are like, oh, certain theater is going to die out. It's like, realistically, the unfortunate part is what's going to happen is we're going to find out which theaters had a better business model than the others. Like,
totally.
How many of them had savings and or a board that could really float them for a couple months?
Totally. Like, and as I just said to you, when I said, you know, the big problem that I see is that most theater is boring, I actually see it as a twofold problem in theater. And I think that the coronavirus, the reformation that's going to come after the coronavirus, I think is going to have to address the... Thank you. It's going to have to address these two issues. And one of them is the fact that we have to admit that theater is usually boring. And the other thing is that theater is too freaking expensive. Like, we can't keep going along with this model. I remember something, it was a while ago. It was maybe something like seven or eight years ago. Jude Law was playing Hamlet, I think with the Don Mar Warehouse or something like that. And it transferred to Broadway. It was a huge hit in London. I mean, a critical hit. They said Jude Law was amazing as Hamlet. He came to Broadway and he was kind of like, meh, you know, people thought he was okay. But still, he's Jude Law. People are going to go see him play Hamlet. And that play was considered a hit. And I remember reading, it broke even. That's what's considered a hit, is that the producers didn't lose, you know, Sonia Friedman or whatever, didn't lose her shirt. And I just was thinking, like, why won't you guys, you know, look at yourselves and ask yourselves, like, what's wrong? Why is theater so bloated? Why is it so expensive? You know, it doesn't have to be this expensive. I'm sure Jude Law wasn't getting his usual salary. I'm sure he was taking a pay cut because he was getting a chance to play, you know, Hamlet on Broadway. That's just unacceptable. And it's not unacceptable from a cold, money-crunching commercial aspect. It's about the art. You know, you're not, something's not working. It costs too much, and people aren't interested enough to see it. You've got to reckon those two things together. I agree with you. I think the business model, we've got to look at it and you've got to be honest about it. I think the answer is actors. I think the answer is improv, really. I look at the model of improv and I'm like, this is a, you know, improv artists put together a spontaneous performance It's all actors. They have the company ethos that has been lost with the theatrical industrial complex and the hierarchy that's been built, where the directors are the top and the designers make all the, you know, design decisions without the actors. And then the actors come in and they're just told where to go and what to do. And it's so silly. You know, when you look at, you know, improvisers, they don't do it that way. It's far more vital and electric and exciting and interesting, and cheaper, quite frankly, and more versatile and more flexible and more intrepid. And that's the way theater really needs to be. And the answer is right in front of us. You just have to reach out and grab it, I think. That's
well, there's
my prediction.
The improv world, what it has that the, you know, organized theater world does not is collaboration and community. Like,
yeah,
you're right.
Yeah.
When the actors arrive, there's a whole other group that, like, sit and stare at you while you do stuff, and then they don't talk to you. I've worked on lots of plays, and the, like, strong lines between groups is crazy. Like,
mm-hmm.
And just the way that it runs in that way. And listen, I understand that usually it runs that way for time and for budget, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. They could probably get a lot of stuff done for a lot cheaper. I mean, honestly,
totally.
The thing that I wish would change in theater for me is the, like, what happens with the community is that people get involved and then people start getting entitled. And then all of a sudden there aren't actual plays that maybe the community who might watch it are interested in seeing, but rather it becomes about the people in the internal theater community getting what they want. And I see that a lot.
Absolutely.
So, you know, there's a give and a take to the way that a theater has to run. And I think that the ones that do really well are the ones that do half and half. If the audience is excited half of the time and then the artists are excited half of the time, I think that's probably best because, you know,
yeah,
it's almost like those theaters where they've got like a big theater stage and then like a smaller one. It's like, yeah, try that experimental stuff on the smaller one. If it packs out, move it to the big one, right? Great. They love it.
Yeah.
It's in. But you need to pay the bills, so like swing Hello Dolly up there and like everyone has a nice time. No one's sad. Everyone loves it. The people that are in it are happy to be in it. Everybody's fine. We could probably spend less on set, but you know, whatever. It's fine.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? Well, it's all repurposed wood.
I hope also that theaters, you know, when they reopen and when they reconstitute after the virus is over, I hope that they'll take back celebration of holidays from the corporations. You know, I don't want Valentine's Day to be a day when, you know, you've got to go and buy Dove, you know, chocolate because that's what is at the grocery store and it's in pink and red wrappers. And, you know, what if, I mean, and I know that obviously the reason why I thought of this was because, you know, the bread and butter of a lot of theater companies is like doing a Christmas carol or something around Christmas time. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think
that needs to be embraced.
One.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I think they should do that with all holidays. I mean, all across the board, especially, you know, reach out to other, you know, marginalized communities and their holidays, you know, immigrant communities, whatever it is. The idea of a holiday being commercialized and packaged and sold to you by a corporation doesn't make any sense. It should be on the grassroots local level, which is what theater is and what theater does well anyway.
Dude, you just had a great idea. Hold on. This is $1 million idea that you need to like find a theater to like get done. You were just talking about Christmas and you were talking about how there's a Christmas carol, but then what if you went to other communities and maybe other cultures and found out what their stories are that commemorate Christmas that are like folk tales
and then do them all.
Dude, that would be that would be the best Christmas pageant ever. Right?
Totally.
Oh, so cool.
Absolutely. And not only that, but also I'll even give you an example of a theater company that I think does this really, really well. And so I'm going to give them a little shout out so that maybe, you know, if anybody can
shout them out.
If they're in Jersey, yeah. So there's a great little theater company. Actually, to be perfectly honest, I haven't been there in a few years. And they're now under new management. But I think they still have the same connection to the community that they used to have, which is sort of my point. There's a theater company called Luna Stage, which is in like South Orange, New Jersey or something like that. And I live in Jersey City. And I used to do plays with the Shakespeare Company in Jersey City. And of course, you know, the audience, if we were lucky, was usually like 20 or 30. You know, it was usually like a marginally larger than the cast, you know, that kind of sad thing. And we used to always be like, why can't we just go out in the neighborhood and try to get people, you know, to come and see Shakespeare? And one of the company members was always like, you know, surely people in this neighborhood, you know, are interested in Shakespeare. And this one really smart actor in my company, I remember him saying, he goes, guys, we're not selling Shakespeare. We're selling theater. It's that bad. I mean, you have to really, you know, try to just get people to just come to the live event. But then Luna Stage out in South Orange that I did a little bit of work with, they were great. And so, like, I went there one time. There was a one-man show about an actor. It was called American Moor. It was about an actor, a one-man show about an actor playing Othello, you know, in this day and age and dealing with racism in the American theater. And, you know, I went to see the show. I was invited by the artistic director because I was friends with her. And it was packed. It was packed with people from the neighborhood, local people. And most of them were African-American. They were interested in seeing this guy's story. And the play was great. And there was a talk back afterwards and everything. And later on in the season, there was another play that Luna Stage had that was all about, it was very, very, very Italian-American. It was about a specific, it took place during the blackout, during the Son of Sam blackout, you know, in the 1970s or something like that. It was very, very specific. And I went to see that show also, and it was the same turnout, the same diversity, local people from the theater. It doesn't matter whether it was, you know, African-American or whether it was Italian-American. It doesn't matter. They had a ironclad connection to their community. What was my point? Why did I bring this up? So I think that's, you know, my point is, you know, yeah, do the Christmas Carol, but also do something for, you know, Hanukkah, do something for, you know, Diwali, yeah, you know, things, right, yeah, around Halloween. Yeah, exactly. Bring everybody in you can possibly bring in. Theaters, that's, especially with Shakespeare, you know, I find that all the time in Shakespeare, with that Shakespeare, you know, of course he was, you know, new research has sort of pretty much proven that Shakespeare was a Catholic. And right during Shakespeare, you know, the time that Shakespeare lived, Catholics were being suppressed and persecuted. So he encodes holidays in a lot of his plays because his Catholic audiences, which were, to be honest, most of the people in England, they just weren't allowed to go to Mass. There was no Mass. There was no celebration. There were no plays that the churches used to put on and stuff. So he would encode these little holidays into his plays. And it was sort of like, you know, the only way these people could celebrate things. You know, The Merchant of Venice is Easter. And, you know, Midsummer Night's Dream is, you know, the May crowning of Mary. And all these kind of, it's so interesting the way he would build it around holidays, because that was already the natural time that people would gather together and see a story. It just seems to me like that's the destiny of theater. We need to go back to that and stop trying to imitate film. You know, get rid of, that's the main thing I would wish for. When theater comes back after this whole virus nonsense, the reformation of theater, like I said, get rid of technology or at least reduce it. Technology should make things easier. They should not make things more cumbersome. I'm so tired of seeing microphones on actors in theater. Like, that doesn't belong. Yeah. For me personally, I don't like it.
Yeah, absolutely not. Ugh. So wait, I feel like we've gone down like a wild rabbit hole into your prophecy, which I'm down for, and I'm into that. But all I've heard about you so far is about how you were in a fourth grade play and how you played Macduff a couple of times. I heard somewhere in the beginning something about a high school play that was perhaps the beginnings of you getting into meaty roles that made you go, ah, yes, I am an actor. Because as I recall, well, I believe I met you in college, and and so you were already ready to be a star at that point. So how'd you get there? What was the high school play that got you going?
Well, so it's interesting, actually. I did do all, you know, the plays that were offered by my high school. The first year I did Alice in Wonderland. The second year I did Our Town. The third year I did The Good Doctor by Neil Simon, which is sort of like a revision. Neil Simon. It's a Neil Simon play that where he reworks a lot of Chekhov plays. It's kind of interesting and funny. And then the last year we did You Can't Take It With You, Kaufman and Hart, which is a great play and everything. But the thing is that's really interesting. I think it's interesting. You know, I don't want to be conceited, but it wasn't those plays that interested me. I actually, the plays were always kind of frustrating to me. What I liked was forensics, you know, speech and debate. Because in speech and debate, you know, I didn't do debates. A lot of my you know, siblings and a lot of my, you know, buddies, they all did debate. But I liked the competitive acting part of it, where you can do scenes, you can do a humor scene or a dramatic scene, and you can also do what they called an interpretation, dramatic interpretation or humorous interpretation, in which case, which is a scene that one actor plays. So you kind of like go from being one character to being another character, and it's really weird, but I really liked it. And what was great about that, the whole speech and debate thing in high school, was you could cast yourself, you could pick your own play, and you could cut it. And so it gave you a lot more, and you sort of had the same process with your performance that like a stand-up comedian has. You know, a stand-up comedian, you know, they have an idea for a few jokes, and they go and they test it out with an open mic. And the jokes that work, they keep, and the jokes that don't work, they don't. And if they think a joke can work, if they change something, they change it. And it's just like this like constant process. That makes so much sense. I wish theater would find a way to adopt that practice. And they don't really. I mean, the closest thing is like the preview period when you do like a Broadway play. And of course, that's the thing which most smaller, more cash-strapped theaters just get rid of. You know, you rarely get any kind of preview period where you can test out like, oh, you know, that joke doesn't work because I'm coming in on my line too slow or whatever. And you've got to work out all that stuff through various rounds of competing with other performances, you know. And so that was, I feel like that was really where I sort of began to sort of decide what I liked and what I didn't like. You know, I think the first thing that any actor really should pay attention to, because I think it's the cornerstone of your, it's going to be the cornerstone of your art, is taste. What do you like? What do you like? What do you think is good acting? What do you think is dramatic? What do you think is interesting? What do you think is scary? What do you think is funny? And if you do those things and the audience does not respond, change. Like, figure out something else. You know, you've got to get them. And, you know, there's a great quote, I think, from Noel Coward, who said, you know, when you're rehearsing a play, he said, do what pleases you first. And then when you get into performance, if it doesn't please the audience, get out of theater. And I kind of, you know, I like the severity of that comment. It's like, you know, you're supposed to be doing this for the audience. So if you're up there navel gazing, or you think something is really, really interesting, and it actually is just pretentious, you will know, because there will be crickets when you think there will be a laugh. Or there will be, you know, complete apathy and boredom where you want there to be intensity. And so that's really, I feel like that's really where my training ground is. And actually, I just reconnected with an actor up here in New York that was one of my competitors. He used to compete against me. And this cat was so good, dude. He used to, like, blow me out of the room. He was so good. I used to go to rounds where I wasn't competing against him just to watch him act, because he was so good. So it's an interesting, and I've only heard of a few actors that sort of came from this world. I think that James Dean did it, Shelley Long, you know, from Cheers. I think she did forensics. Most recently, you know, the actor Michael Urie, you know, the actor Michael Urie, he was in, Ugly Betty and, a few other things. He also did, forensics. I think there's even a documentary about the speech competition world. And what it's like, you know, these actors, these competitive actors.
I really thought everybody got involved in it except for me. I mean, I went to a private Catholic high school and it was all girls. So they like didn't really do many competitions. And we had to like beg to have a play like senior year. So like we didn't really have, you know, anything. We went to the boys' school to do plays and stuff like that. So like when I heard years later, and when I went to college and I found out that like people in high school had been traveling around and doing competing performances, I was like, what? I missed it. It's my whole, yeah. That's all I want to do. But it just, I missed it. It was not a thing that was part of my life. So, but it sounds yeah. really cool and really awesome. So let's move forward. How did you get into, what was your, I know that clearly, I mean, I guess we went to the same college, but like for you, what was your college? And then you went to grad school too, right? Like experience. How did the education part post high school go for you? You really soaked up all actoring.
Yeah, so I, you know, I came from this family of, you know, like I said, sort of, you know, actors and speechifiers and stuff like that. That's really just kind of the family I came from. But they also were, you know, like you were saying, really Catholic. And my mom and dad pulled some sort of weird ass Jedi mind trick on me, and they were like, you have to go to a Catholic school. But they didn't offer me any money to go there. So they're just like, you'll figure it out, but you have to go to a Catholic school. And I look back on this, I'm like, how did they pull that off? But they did. So I could only look at Catholic school. And I went to go see my sister, Nora, who I assume maybe you know or you saw.
I do know.
Maybe not. So I saw my sister, Nora, at the University of Dallas. And I just thought Pat Kelly's plays were so good. They blew me away. So I was like, okay, I want to go here. So that's why I wanted to go to the
University of
Dallas.
What did you see her in that you were like, yeah, what's up? Or did you see all of her?
I saw her in the 12th Night playing Viola, and it was good. It was good production. Everything was great. But it wasn't, I mean, when I saw her in the Tempest, Pat Kelly's production of The Tempest blew me away.
Oh,
it's, it's one of the top three productions I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And I've since then reconnected with Bryant Mason and Kyle Lemieux. And I've told them, I've been like, guys, that was the best performance of The Tempest I've ever seen, ever.
Yo, The Tempest had to have been the best thing in the whole wide world. The lead in the play became the head of the drama department. That's what he won. Boom.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
He was so good. They were like, wow, that's just, listen, do you want to go to grad school and then come back? Because you're pretty much the best, and that's what we like. They're not wrong. Exactly. He is the best. But that was my favorite. I loved that. Oh, that was my sophomore year. Yeah. Loved that play.
Well, I was just talking to my sister about this recently. I even told Bryant when I met up with him up here in New York many years ago. I told him, like, I never realized that the role Antonio in The Tempest isn't that big of a role. But Bryant made it seem like it was, you know, a big role because it was, you know, he's the main villain and everything. And because Bryant was so good in it, like, it blew me away. So then I wanted to go to UD. And so when I went to UD, UD, in a similar way to the speech competitions in high school, you know, the speech competitions in high school, you got many opportunities to act. You cut your own script, you cast yourself, you read a bunch of plays until you figured out the one you wanted to do. And then you would, you would perform it in several rounds. I mean, you performed it so much. And there was sort of a similar quality, I feel like, at UD because, you know, as you know, the program was sort of geared towards teaching you how to direct a play. But in order to do that, you had to have a lot of actors so that you could be, you know, doing a lot of scenes, like in the directing lab class, which I thought was an incredible class. And so I got to just be in a lot of plays. I mean, I remember actually when I auditioned for grad school, a lot of my fellow classmates who were also auditioning, you know, you all have to hand in your resume and your headshot. And, you know, they had, you know, pittances on their resume. You know, they'd been in a few things. They were in the chorus in their college production or whatever. And then my resume came along. And I was Jason in Medea. I was Creon in Antigone. I was Trigorin in The Seagull. I was Falstaff in Henry IV, 1 and 2. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. There was so much opportunity to act because, as you know, each director had to do a play for their thesis. So there was, you know, so many parts. Like, I still kind of regret this, but, you know, a lot of the students, or, you know, the students, all the students, go to Rome for half their semester, and I actually didn't. I elected to not go to Rome because I wanted to do the plays that were going on the next semester. I was like, oh my god, I can't leave when they're about to do Merchant of Venice. I can't leave when they're about to do the Trojan Women. You know, that
oh my
kind of
god,
stuff.
You're so funny.
Yeah, I know. I know. I It's so silly, but it worked, you know. And I remember
you can still go there. You're an alum. Just tell them, and then you can go visit. It's real.
Yeah, exactly.
You can.
And I remember one of my acting teachers in grad school when they were, you know, when they were looking at my resume and they were sort of interviewing me after my audition. And, awesome. You know, I remember her looking at my resume and going, "You play Creon and Jason and Trigorin?" And I was like, "Yeah." And she was like, and I remember her just being kind of bug-eyed. You know, and she ended up becoming, you know, one of my favorite teachers. She was amazing. But like, so that did have an effect. And then I went to Columbia. So Columbia is where I went to get my master's degree. Pat Kelly had sort of a regular, our the head of the program at University of Dallas. He had sort of a regular directing gig at the Colorado Shakespeare Festival. And I was asking him about, you know, what he thought about, you know, my getting a master's and what sort of, you know, training I should get. And he just told me, he was like, "Well, I just came from Colorado Shakespeare Festival." He's like, "I worked with, you know, kids that went to Juilliard, kids that went to Yale." He was like, "All the kids that went to Columbia were the best." And I was like, okay. So I'll put all my eggs into that basket. And I didn't get in anywhere else. I applied to every school on the face of the planet, and it just so happened that I got into Columbia. So I sort of felt like that was providence. And the greatest Shakespeare teacher in America taught at Columbia. So that sort of just snapped it all up for me. I was like, you know, I got to go here. It was expensive, and I'm not going to mention to you how in debt I am. But
no, let's not talk about
at the
it.
Same. Yeah, let's not do that. But at the same time, I did learn what I set out to learn, and that is something I can say with absolute confidence. I knew what I wanted to learn. I knew what I didn't know, and I got it from Columbia. Like, they really did. They knew, and they taught me. So
then,
you know,
really, is it a debt, or is it like? You're
exactly,
gladly
exactly.
going to pay back this thing. Like, because really,
exactly.
We all talk about our college debt and whatnot and like, rah, rah, rah. I had a great time. I had a lovely time.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'll ever be able to give them back all that money because I don't have a lot. But, you know, I sure do appreciate it. You know what I mean? Like whatever amount I'll end up being able to actually pay for it, great. But it was a good experience. And if I'm going to have debt on my you know, credit report, no matter what, I'd rather it be debt for having an amazing experience and learning things I wanted, right?
Totally, totally. And I'm going to give
Columbia.
A little bit more.
Mm.
I'm going to give a little bit more credit to one other person. There was an actress in Dallas named Emily Gray, and she and her husband, Matt Gray, founded this company called the Classical Acting Company. And I remember I had a conversation with Emily. This was the year after University of Dallas, before I went to Columbia. So I took a year off. And I remember talking to her, and I said, I was wondering about going to school, but it was going to be so expensive. And she said to me, she goes, "Go ahead and go to school. You know, take on the debt, do whatever." She goes, "You know, let's say the worst happens." She goes, "They can't, you know, repossess your knowledge. They can't repossess your degree. So just do it." And I was like, "You're right. You know, I mean, I do want to pay it off, and it is an enormous amount. But, you know, you just said it, and Emily said it at that time also. Like, I got what I wanted. So it's not really a debt. You know, it's just something I'm trying to pay off."
Yeah, and they got to figure out how they handle their financials better, because realistically,
yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's all
them.
A racket.
It's
I
on
mean,
them. It's not you. You're
it
great.
Really is. I mean,
you're amazing.
Yeah, Columbia was also, you know, was a mess financially. I mean, they charged way too much. I think actually I read somewhere that they offered the least amount of financial aid of any MFA acting program in the country. And it was like, thanks, guys.
Oh, sure.
But, you know,
they're like, "You want an MFA? Well, you better have some cash." Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of that.
Exactly.
There's a lot of that. But so after you went to Columbia and you got your MFA, what was the next step for you? Like, what do you do after going to grad school? How do you get involved?
Well, so, you know, I everything I did, I wouldn't say it was a mistake. It was just weird. I just did everything differently than everybody. So I was already married when I went to Columbia, with, you know, my wife, Megan. You know her. She was in your thesis production at UD. And we ended up having a kid while I was in grad school, which in a way was great because all my classmates rallied around me. They all thought my kid was the bee's knees and they all doted on him. And, you know, there were a lot of petty sort of diva fights that happened between a lot of my classmates. And I was always out of it. I was never involved in any of that nonsense because I had to go home and hang out with my baby, you know, my kid. But at the same time, that did make for a very strange beginning to an acting career. I would not advise someone who's, you know, considering, you know, starting an acting career, for them to start a family, you know, but I did. And that's just who I am and how I rolled with things. So I had a kid, and Megan ended up getting a really, really great job. And so I was sort of, you know, mostly staying home with my son and submitting myself for parts. You know, I auditioned and I got an agent right when I got out of grad school. She wasn't very good, and I ended up switching her about 2 years later for the agent that I'm still with. So, you know, that's something. Though the game was changing, right? You know, on a sort of a professional logistical level, it was changing right when I graduated from grad school. So, and I wonder, to be honest. I mean, I love my agent, and I hope he does not go the way of the dinosaur. But I do wonder if agents in general are going to go the way of the dinosaur, because most of the submissions that I, you know, that led to auditions and then that led to jobs, I did them myself. And, you know, Actors Access, the website where you can sort of submit yourself for professional projects and things like that, that was just sort of coming into existence. And that was most of the traction that I got, was just submitting myself, you know, utilizing the tools that are available. So I had sort of a strange experience compared to a lot of my compadres. I was, you know, mostly at home babysitting a kid and submitting myself for roles. And occasionally I would get an audition or a role or something. And when I would get an audition, it was a nightmare. I'd have to juggle, you know, beg some friend of mine to watch my kid while I went into an audition, because of course I was the, you know, primary caretaker for my kid. And that did not make things easy, but
I feel you.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's like, but I don't care. I mean, I liked my kid, you know, I wanted to be around him, and it's a lot of fun, you know, being with kids. I think it can be very, it can feed your creativity a lot, you know, being with kids.
It makes you look at things a different way, for sure. It definitely reframes things. You're able to watch movies in a new and different way, you know? I find that I'm sort of like sweeter. My heart is softer than it was. You know, I'm quite cynical about a lot of things. But, you know, if I watch a good Disney movie, I mean, they get me and I'm crying. I'm like, they love each other. You know, it's great. It's great.
I have a funny story right about that. I remember my older sister had a bunch of kids, you know, before me. And I was right when my son was born, and I was at Columbia, was right when the first Incredibles Pixar movie came out. The movie about the superhero family, you know, the cartoon about the superhero family. And I asked my sister if she'd saw it. And she said, "Oh, no. I saw it, but I couldn't handle it. It was too rough for me." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" And she said, well, there's that scene where the mom is on the plane, the jet plane, and those missiles, you know, are shot at the plane. And she goes, I can't handle that. I can't handle a mother, you know, in danger with her babies. Mm-hmm. And I was like, "You're a wuss," you know. And the movie had just come out on DVD. And I remember Megan was out for the evening or something, and my son was asleep on our bed. And I had gotten The Incredibles. I hadn't seen it yet. From Netflix, in the little DVD sleeve that they used to send, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'm watching the DVD, old school. So I'm watching the Incredibles, and that scene came up, you know, where she's flying. So now I'm a dad, I now have a kid, and that scene comes up that my sister had referenced that I did not know about. And it was like someone flipped a switch. I burst into tears, and I started having a panic attack, and I had to pause it. I was like, I can't handle this mom, you know, with these, you know, missiles flying at her plane while her kids are in danger. It just freaked me out. So there's something about having a kid, which I think is wonderful for creatives and for actors. I mean, I don't think you should go out and purposely have kids.
Don't.
Just to, you know, just to reignite your creative life. Mm-mm. But I mean, there's nothing wrong with it, but it was weird and it was different. And, yeah.
I think it opens up a like channel of sensitivity that like you didn't have before, or, you know, maybe reignites it from your childhood or something like that to connect to that kind of thing. Like you had it, but then life filled it in with sadness and now it's cleaned out and you're able to like see through that hole in your heart again. But you know what's crazy? This is the terrible byproduct of a long time in improv. My brain is extra exercised to come up with cool and new ideas just immediately. It's a thing. It's what I do. And that's great, except for it also functions to elicit terrible imaginations of things that will happen to my child and myself in which we are going to be murdered or hurt in some way, in which I'm in a car accident where I have to like pry myself out and get him, or like he's running through traffic. I imagine these things with such vivid, like, I did not know I had this movie in my brain the way that I do, but I will like feel it. I'll be driving down the road and all of a sudden, like, I'll be nervous of a car that's swerving near me. I'll imagine my entire death. And then I'm like, oh my God, oh, you cannot do this. Keep driving. Good Lord. And it's just in my head, you know? Oh,
yeah.
It's a crazy thing. Yeah, but I never thought about those things.
Yeah, but you're right. I mean, it's reality. It's reality smacking you in the face of who humans are. And I mean, we all started out as that. We all started out as babies. I think you become much more forgiving of your parents when you become a parent because you think, oh God, man, you know, like this is a nightmare. Like how did my parents do it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally.
How both of them had so many jobs. How did I see them ever? Like, you think about it, you know, like, well, I'll talk to my sister where I'm like, how did we go on vacation? When was that? was there like a jar with pennies? Like what? Oh my God. Like, how did they do that? You know, can I see the budget sheets? Like, come on. You know, just things where you're like, it's impossible that they accomplished. Like, we lived a lavish lifestyle. Like, what is happening right now?
And I think a lot of that is, where the world went. But, it was different. It was weird. You know, most of my fellow actors didn't have kids. So that, in a way, became kind of a novelty. And it became an interesting little litmus test.
Yeah.
You know, some actors that I would be in a play with were like, ew, that's weird. You have a kid. And then I was like, okay, you're not the type of person I want to hang out with. And then other people would be like, oh my gosh, you have a kid. That's amazing. And I'd be like, okay, well, you're the person that I'm going to invite over to my house after, you know, our opening night party. And you get to hang out with my kids and, you know, have a drink with me and whatever. I don't regret it, but it did make things weird. You know, having a kid, trying to start a career, you know, in New York, you know. But the biggest sort of revelation I had about my career and everything, and this is what sort of has led me to where I am in my career now, which is, technically speaking, if I was going to just be objective about it, I would say I took a break. I took a break for about, it's been about 4 years now, just about. I haven't done a play in about 4 years. I don't mind that. Well, again, it was because we were having another kid. So I was like, you know, well, I need to find a good solid day job now. And I found a really good job, you know, walking dogs for millionaires and billionaires with a company that's comprised almost exclusively of other actors. So I get along with everybody in the company and everything.
Nice.
And you can imagine how that business has done during the coronavirus. All of our clientele pieced out to the Hamptons and everything. Exactly. But that was the break. And taking a break is an interesting thing. Because you feel like you're not an actor anymore, but it's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing to take breaks. And you know, one of my favorite actors is Elizabeth Marvel. I don't know if you know who that is, but she's a stage actor. She's done a few movies and a few TV shows and stuff, but she's a goddess on stage. I mean, she's worshipped. And I remember reading an interview with her, and her husband, he's an actor too. Did you see that TV show, The Outsiders, that was on HBO?
I didn't watch it, but I'm aware of it.
You should check it out. It's really good. But anyway, he's in that. His name is Bill Camp. You know, he's off-Broadway royalty. So is she. And I remember reading an interview with her, and she said that, you know, they had a kid, and Bill Camp just took some time off. He just, you know, was like, okay, I'm going to go be a cook for a while or something. I think maybe she said he was also a mechanic for a while. He just took time off. And, you know, and she referenced it like it was no big thing. And he came back. You know, he came back. He's done Broadway roles. He's done stuff on TV. He's done stuff in movies. So it's not like, it's not a death sentence. Don't be afraid of taking time off. If you need to just take time off, you know, as you and I have been talking about, you know, like when you have a kid, it makes you a better person. It makes you a better artist. It makes you a better, you know, a full, well-rounded person. So if you need to take time off, especially if it's to spend time with them or to attend to your life in some other way, I haven't missed not being in plays. And a lot of that is because, you know, I'm very opinionated, and I think a lot of plays weren't done in the right way. But yeah, so I guess, I don't know, that's sort of the main thing I would sort of feel about my career. It was underwhelming. You know, I did a lot of plays. I'm very happy with the plays that I did. But it's not like, you know,
sounds like you have some more work to do. Sounds like you got some more work to do. You're not like done.
Yeah.
You're just taking a break.
No, not at
all.
You
just took a break for a little bit. You know, really, like, real life is something to be experienced, especially by a person who considers themselves an artist, such that you are communicating stories of human life to other people. If you don't get to experience it, like, how can you really put it up in front of people? And like, I get it. Some people are just like, can pretend anything, and you're like, wow, they're really good at that and great. But I feel like for some of us, it's more of a spiritual experience, and it's more of a like being in touch with the moment kind of scenario when you act. And so it's really great if you've been in an experience like parenthood, like having a family, like things not going well occasionally in your life. It really helps with just general empathy as a human, but it also helps when you're an actor, because being an actor is just like empathy plus a show, right? Like, we understand where you're coming from. Here, let me show you. I'm going to pretend to be someone like you. Check it out. And then it's like, wow, you did it. I really thought you were like me. And they're like, it's true. But actually, I'm a single man who lives in an apartment alone on the Upper West Side. You never would believe it. Right? But not you, right?
Yes.
I think it's important to, especially to, even as a human, not just as an actor, but as a human, to experience all the things that we're allowed to experience. Not everybody gets to do all the things, and that's fine, you know? I don't need to do all the things, but when I get the opportunity, when the world says, hey, Aim, did you think that you were going to make it to your 40s and not have a child? Turns out, not so much. You're going to have a kid at 39. Who's excited? You are, right? I thought, well, gosh, this wasn't what I was planning on doing, but I get the opportunity to do it, so then I did it, right? Like,
yeah, now, do you think that your expertise in improv, do you think that bleeds into the way you live your life? I'm curious, because, like, do you enjoy improvising life in a way?
No, I think that improv is a good religion in the way that meditating is good for life, because improv is an exercise in everything changing around you. Improv is an exercise in chaos, and life is chaos.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you can stay cool and pay attention during chaos, then you will be lucky in the rest of your life, because you have the ability to navigate this crazy thing. But improv is more of a like chaotic exercise meditation than it is a way of life. I personally think of us, of people, the way like, almost like people in a play, right? I was a stage manager for a long time. And while it's unlikely that I will stage manage another play, I don't know, maybe I will, it's still my personality. It's who I am. I'm an organizer. I organize things. Right. I'm a producer. I make sure things happen. Right now, as I'm at home not doing stuff, the things that I'm thinking about doing are creating shows in which other people can do them. I don't necessarily want to perform myself that much anymore. I really like providing other people with opportunities to perform, or writing for them so that they can perform, or doing different things where me, like, I love this conversation that we're having because, like, it's cool that two actors can discuss, like, what life is like. And I want to listen to other people's. I want to put people together and say, you guys should talk so I can listen to your conversation. Like, I want to organize stuff versus necessarily, like, I'm in on the journey in the organization, but I want to, like, be the gardener as opposed to the flower.
You know? Yeah.
And that's something that I've been thinking a lot about in coronavirus. Like, I've been like, okay, but like, what do you really miss? What are the things? Because I haven't performed in a long time. I've performed in film and commercials, which are fun, but a different vibe than anything theater, right? But I love teaching improv and sketch comedy. And so it's almost the same for me, because realistically, every time I teach, it's just a performance. It's like 2 hours of me doing a show. Hey guys, let me tell you all about this. Okay.
That's what I noticed with my parents. You know, like I said, my parents were both actors, and then they both became teachers. And there was a little period, I think when I was in like high school, I think my younger sister started it, but she was in high school, and she was like, hey dad, I want to go to see your class, you know, your college class that you teach. And he was like, all right, fine. So he would let her sit in on his lectures. And then I was like, well, I want to go and do that too. And that's when I realized, when I saw my dad lecturing, like, oh, this is how they get that bug out. You know, the needing to perform and needing to, you know, teaching is, that's the one thing I hope I can figure out in my life, but also sort of, you know, project to the world, which is, if you are a natural performer, And I think a lot more people are natural performers in our world than the people that end up becoming actors in the profession. Public speaking is most people's biggest fear. So if you don't have that fear, if you can do it, I almost feel like you have an obligation to do it for your community, to stand up in front of your community and talk. And I think that's where most teachers find themselves. So if there was one thing I wish I could, you know, really nail down or sort of explore in this next phase of my life, it's that teaching is badass. It shouldn't be this whole idea of like, oh, you've failed, so now you're becoming a teacher. It's like, no, I mean, Shakespeare was a teacher, and we know this. I mean, we just recently found this out recently, that he was almost certainly a teacher. They said that he was a teacher in the countryside, and that was part of his training before he became an actor and then a playwright. And I think that,
I mean, you know, like, forevermore, even to Shakespeare's time, the only one making money is the theater teachers. Let's be honest.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and that's the other thing. And you were talking about business, you know, the business model, you know, in theaters and how that needs to change. You know, every professional theater has an education wing, because that's where a lot of the money is and that's where a lot of the interest is. But it's never integrated with the actual main stage actors, usually. Almost usually it's not. You know, they have a bunch of teaching artists that are people that, you know, are marginalized and sort of shoved aside. That needs to be the same people. The people doing the main stage shows need to be the people teaching. If you are good enough at acting that you can do it really well, then you can teach it really well. And if you can teach acting really well, you can do it really well. And those things, you know, the idea of those that can't do teach, we need to abolish that when it comes to actors. I mean, I don't think that's true at all. But it's a horrible thing that our society says. Sure. And I know for myself, you know, this next phase of my career, what I want is to fuse acting, teaching, and directing. You know, I'm not interested anymore in, you know, not passing on all this cool stuff that I've learned. Because most of the stuff that I've learned with my incredibly expensive education, it's not that applicable in the acting profession. The acting profession, just, you know, day to day pounding the pavement, you don't need a huge classical education. But if you have it, you should share it. And it's great. It's wonderful. And it makes you a better actor, makes you a better teacher, makes you a better director, all of that. I think.
Good. Hey, Terrence, yeah. Thank you so much for chatting with me and for going down wild rabbit holes of like acting and life with me. This has been a really great episode. Thank you so much for being on it.
Of course. I'll do it again anytime. You're awesome, Amy. I love it.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.